father, he was a husband, he was a grandfather, he was many, many things, but what would you say is, you know, number one, what was his greatest role?
I've had the opportunity to do a lot of talks in schools and other places about Caesar over the years, and especially since his passing. And as important as he was in U.S. labor history, I always think that that was the least of all his valued roles as a leader, as a person. And I think his top roles was the best role I knew him to play was as a grandfather. He had 39 grandchildren and great-grandchildren when he passed, and he had the greatest relationship with them, a busy leader with a lot of pressure could have, and it was a powerful role. He played it well. They will never, those who are old enough, and that's most of them, old enough to remember, will never forget the love and the lessons that he was able to give and share with them. It was so authentic. It was so real. He was always at his best in terms of being silly and having fun, whether they were infants or grown. He was at his best and silliest, his most authentic, loose personal self at times, especially the two times that were the best for him in that role, because he didn't take off much time to even do that. But the best, and his grandkids, like our eldest daughter, Barbara, when she was 2-3 years old, she had the run of La Paz, and she could walk into any important meetings he had going on and just walk up and sit in his lap and take over the meetings, because that was his granddaughter, and she could come in and do that. Whether, and it was applied to all of his grandchildren from time to time. But the I'd say the Christmas time and Easter time were some of the best times of the grandfather. He would insist after midnight mass that no matter how many kids and in-laws came, that the presents were open. He'd give every kid, every person their gift and just celebrate it and be excited about it. And that was his role. You couldn't take that away from him. And on Christmas, and then Easter, he would just have a lot of fun with the Easter egg hunt. He would sometimes even help with the barbecue, even though he didn't eat meat or chicken or fish. At times he would help with the barbecue because he was a good sport. But then the biggest thing was his annual Easter softball game with his grandkids. And it was the last real family activity we were able to enjoy with him several weeks before he passed, suddenly and surprisingly. But that day he was at his best, and he was there in his sweatshirt, and he had a Corona beer, which he didn't do often. He had a beer there in the pitcher's mound. He pitched for both teams. And he would tell the kid with the, he was joking with the children playing and tell him he would get his power from the corn chips he would get. He'd get power from that, and just had a lot of fun doing that, and they had a lot of fun, and he would enjoy it. So that was those are some of his key times or best times with his grandchildren that I thought was his biggest and best role. Then you take that from there, and there was the role of just being a leader and example to so many, you know, hundreds of people who worked for him, thousands of people he spoke to and influenced about. He used to call it teaching people how to be people. And how to be gracious to others. But and go ahead. I'm sorry,
Richard. I just want to ask a little bit here. I mean, from a grandfather, this whole idea of him being silly and funny. I mean, this is a side of Caesar that very few people see. I mean, what did that say about him?
Well, it was part and parcel of him. I mean, he had a great sense of humor. And so as serious as his life work was, as focused and disciplined as he had to be to take on the challenges that were, far bigger than most people ever dream about taking on, he had, as part of his core makeup, a great sense of humor. So he loved to laugh and joke and hear jokes, many dimensions from different angles and different types. So it was part of him to like to laugh, and I think that really helped to keep him balanced under all the pressures he faced.
Right. Now, you got to know him as a son-in-law, but what were your thoughts? What did you see about Caesar as a father, because a grandfather is one relationship, a father is a different one. What? How did he deal with his children?
I think they all had a loving and respectful relationship with him, but I think that not having the time, because he had to, in a way, offered and gave him up to the world, and lost a lot in the in that exchange. They didn't have a lot of time with him. He wasn't there a lot. He was their father. They loved him. They respected him. They followed him. They supported him. They worked for him. They worked with him. They treated him like a regular father. He wasn't a famous guy in his household. But on the other hand, as I've met people over the years, I've had comments from people saying, Mike, who really are thoughtful to say, I'd love to meet your wife someday and shake her hand and thank her for having given their father up for us, because in that role he was limited. And so, I don't know how much he was ever able to explain, his poverty that he gave to them, his vow of poverty that they took, whether they wanted to or not. They were part of it. And he would do things, though. They always, every so often in his family history, he'd have, he did several things. When they were small and before he started the union, he would make sure they took vacations and went camping a lot. And they'd go to usually Carpinteria. And he would, again, be a dad with a camera. And he was always a camera, a camera or a photographer of some note, because he learned a lot about photography, like he did about any subject that interested him. And so, but I remember I broke his bubble one time when I told him that something that he didn't know had happened when he used to take the kids camping. He'd cook eggs, and they didn't like the way he cooked them, and they would take them and bury them in the sand. And that was like years later. He was like crushed when I, in a fun way, but he was crushed when I told him that it had happened. And oh, the family got on me for it, because I let him know that secret, a guarded secret. But he did things like that, and he would have family meetings every so often, including before he started the union. You know, he had had an offer from the Kennedy administration to work in Latin America in the State Department or some kind of job when he was the head of the CSO nationally out of Los Angeles, and they lived in Boyle Heights. And he had a family meeting saying, look, we have a couple of options. We can go and become part of this government deal in Latin America, and we'll have drivers and servants and these other things and this easy life, or we can go to Delano and do these wonderful things for poor people. And I think he was smart enough and politically astute enough to convince them that that was the better option. He'd have family meetings. They'd have a voice, but he knew how to convince them, and they loved going along with him on everything and anything he did over the years. I think, but with the exception of they were, not only do you miss the time, but you've had to face realities and harsh realities that other kids didn't have to face, both because of your dad's voluntary poverty, so you didn't get new dolls or new bikes at different times. And when they would ask for that, he would always answer for anything they wanted. Was the answer from him was, when the eagle flies, you'll get all that. When the eagle flies. And so
Richard,
they grew up,
let's talk a little bit about this voluntary poverty. What was it about voluntary poverty that was so essential to his drive, his vision, his view of the movement?
I think that was part of his authenticity and power, is that anyone who would do that was for real. And you couldn't just mouth it. You had to live it. And so that gave him, I think, instant credibility with a lot of people who, like anyone would question, how for real is this guy? What is he really about? It told you a lot. It was very telling, and you knew it was true. And so it was, and once you joined him in that voluntary poverty, you really were, as he used to describe, you were freed in a sense. You were no longer bound by other reasons or forms of conformity. You were free to be who you wanted to be, and to borrow a phrase, create your own reality. And he was very adept at that. And voluntary poverty, based on his religious beliefs and the teachings from Gandhi and St. Francis, people who had given up their worldly goods, I think those examples pushed him in a way that as he evolved as a person and his understanding of the world and of his role in it, and as a leader of a movement evolved, and his as an example to other people. You had to live that example, and he just thought that it was key that if he was going to serve and represent poor people, he had to be as poor as them.
Now, along with dragging in his children into his vision, he also was a husband. Could you talk a bit about, you know, what you saw from his with his relationship with Helen, and you know his role as a father, and also her role as a wife and as a rock in terms of the union and you know, where they were going.
And maybe I'll start at the back end first on that one, because there's a. It's an interesting thing. I don't think he often, you know, very often in the years they were married, in 1948, so 45 years of marriage, just about. In those 45 years, I don't think he often wrote things to her, you know, gave her letters or notes. After he passed away on... The Friday that he passed, April 23rd of 1993. For several days, Helen was very much in shock and very, very down. And on Sunday, as we were waiting for his body to be brought to be laid in state there in La Paz, she went to his desk to look for something. And in it, she found a card, a beautiful card, very colorful, sort of Indian symbols with birds on the artistic birds on the front. And she opened the card, and it was dated about, my goodness, I can't remember quite off the top of my head, but at least 15 years earlier. It was a card he had written to her when he was on the road once and never given to her. And, boy, it was about, it read something like... it was a tough one, because it would read something like, "My dearest darling, we're like the sand in the water," and just really got to how, explained to her how she was his strength. And the moment she read that, she came immediately out of her shock and began cooking for the dozens and hundreds of people who were coming there to visit her and visit the family. That was the sort of the penultimate, because it was after... The penultimate, because it was after he had passed that she got that note, and it depicted their relationship in the best way he could. Going backward again, over the years, they were, I think the Christmas before he passed, the grandkids convinced them both that they just one more time they had to get out and jitterbug for them. And they were great jitterbuggers, both of them. Helen was a great partner, Caesar was a great dancer, and that was one of their real fun things they did together throughout life. And they're a very outstanding couple on the dance floor. But coming back to that, she was always the pillar of the family, as she remains today. Quiet, soft-spoken, never in the media, maybe once or twice in her life for good reasons and good times. But she liked the background. She was strong. She was, her father... had been a colonel in Pancho Villa's war, so she had no fear. During different times of the early strikes, she and others stood in front of trains that were about to run them over and trucks and whatever else. She was on the picket lines. When Caesar began the movement, she supported the family financially, so she was the rock, she was the glue. He would oftentimes over the years surprise her with, you know, one or two or 20 or 40 people for lunch or dinner, and within minutes, she was seriously a marvelous, in the top 5% of cooks you'll ever meet in your life. And so she could cook for two people or 2,000 people, and today still people will call her for, how much do you need for this many people? What do you do? Her food is great, but she ran the credit union. She was that they had for many, many years. That was her job, was a credit union. And any other role that she needed to play, but she was the one that carried the family through the toughest times, because she was there, and she faced the tough times with him, without him at times, but she was a rock in the movement, and really, you know, was a partner who was quiet in the background. She never wanted a front seat. She never wanted the roles. to be public, but she, because she was just shy that way, in a genuine way. But in terms of being, having her own convictions and backing what he did, if she hadn't been there, we wouldn't be talking about him today.
Right. Now, what was do you think, you know, you as a husband, now that you know what it's like to be a husband and a father, what was the key to that relationship that made that relationship work? Because it was so important not only for the family, but for the whole movement. What was the thing that made him click?
You know, it's a great, that's like all the others, a great question. I think part of it was that when, it was unspoken, but when he came in the door, she was in charge. And she and the children didn't ever really understand when they were younger, and as they grew older and understood, they never treated him any different than anyone else treats their father. And I was always, especially in the beginning when I noticed it so much, I was always amazed by that all the publicity of their father didn't change how they saw him and how they treated him, at least at home. And so part of the key there is Helen was, you know, the things she needed at home, she would say them. And there wasn't, when he came in that door, he was a father and a husband, and they had good chemistry, good they combined their roles well, and she was very much in support of anything and everything he did. So he had her as a rock for his support and backup, and in turn, she helped to create that supportive network around the children and the rest of the family.
Now, I want to see if there is a link here, but how did those relationships translate into his role as a labor leader? Where was the connection there?
How did which roles translate?
Well, all those skills that he had as a father, as a grandfather, as a husband, as you know, somebody who really, really cared, how did they translate into his role as a leader of a movement? Because this seems to be a much bigger family. It's an extension of his family. Do you think that some of those attributes that he brought to his family, that he brought, and love that he brought to his family, he also brought to the movement?
I think that you've really hit it well in the question, because it went both ways.
Right.
As he evolved over time, they allowed him and shared with him as he learned and evolved as a leader, as he got greater understanding of the world, as he self-educated and self-taught himself in so many new things and ways, they were right along for the ride with him. They were part of it, and they allowed him to do it as he evolved from someone who was a working dad when they were in San Jose to someone who went to the church to learn about labor, reading the Rerum Novarum and all those things from I think it was Leo the 13th, but all the church labor teachings, the social teachings that he started to learn under Father McDonald in San Jose at Our Lady of Guadalupe Church. Those were parts of his evolution, and he would share those with his family. And I think they allowed him to learn, because he needed to learn a lot. He didn't know a lot back then, and he evolved quickly and is an astute student of life and labor. So he took what he learned, I think what he had learned from his own family, especially his mom. His dad would teach him about, you know, organizing life and farms and those things, but his mom taught him about how to treat people. And he was very close to her, and she was very religious and very spiritual. And he took that into his contact with others, and he would not, he never veered from treating every person the same. You could be wealthy and powerful, or poor and powerless, and he'd treat you the same. So he expressed that dignity, and it carried over into labor well, because especially at that generation, I mean, he, you know, while he was respected by some in labor in those days when he was coming up, a lot of people in labor resented him because he didn't make a big salary and he didn't wear a suit. And so he was different. And their members of other unions, when he'd go speak, spoke to many national, international union convention, and they'd take up collections, $50,000, $70,000, $80,000 off the convention floor to give him a union. And It had to have caused a little bit, with all but a few labor leaders, it had to cause them some concern because their members responded to him better than they did to their own leaders, because he had this ability to communicate with them very directly, very simply, and they got it. He did that whether it was labor or church groups or community groups. His message, his vision was so clear and simple that when he explained it, with very few exceptions of the things he tried to do, they got it and were able to say yes or no to do or take whatever steps he was asking of them.
Now, Richard, you just hit on something very important, and actually the next section I'd like to talk about, the next theme, which